Okay, 3 weeks ago, at the beginning of this month, we started the Old Testament overview class, but then we were gone the next week, and then we had the meeting last week, so it's been a while. And let me just refresh you on what the class is about. Just as the title suggests, it is an overview class. That means we are not going to be going into great detail on any of the books that we're covering. And what we're going to be doing in this quarter is we're going to cover, on average, one book per class. And we're going to go way up high, take the 35,000 foot view, looking down. Instead of looking at the trees, we're going to look at the forest and see the main concepts behind the book, see the big picture, see how it fits in with the message that God is trying to give to everybody, all of his people, whether it be the people of the Israelites, the Israelite people, or whether it be us, and see how that all fits together as a whole. I think it's very valuable for us to do this with any book, really, and then with the Bible as a whole, because if we have a tendency sometimes of when we are studying the Bible, studying a particular book, to get bogged down into the details. And of course, looking at the details is great and wonderful. We need to do that, but we do need to step back and take a look at the big picture so that we can see the overall message and not get bogged down as we sometimes do. So that's what the purpose of the class is. And last time I just gave some introductory remarks about the Old Testament and some of the books, why we need to study the books, why we need to study the Old Testament. And we looked at also one of the questions that I left you with. This is your homework assignment. For those of you that are in the Facebook group, I posted it on Facebook yesterday as well. The homework assignment that I gave you 3 weeks ago was why the particular land that God gave Israel, why the land of Canaan. And by the way, I'm having to stand behind this mic because we cannot find the lapel mic anywhere. I don't know where it is. So I will do my best to do this. But let me show you again the map that I showed you 3 weeks ago. I hope you can make this out. This is, of course, Egypt. I think most of us are probably familiar with some of the basic geographical areas here in the Bible world. Egypt, of course, a world power for many, many, many hundreds of years, thousands of years even. And then Anatolia, which is modern-day Turkey in New Testament times. It became known as Asia Minor. That was a significant area in the New Testament. We have Mesopotamia, which is the area around the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that you may or may not be able to make out on this map here. And of course, that's ancient Babylon area would be included in that. And then you have the Levant region, which is just the area of Canaan, Palestine in the New Testament. It would include Aram in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, it's called Syria, still called Syria today, of course, but that's just due north of Palestine. Canaan in the Old Testament, or Israel, once Israel got there. So that Levant region is right in between Egypt, Anatolia, and Mesopotamia, and God gave them basically that land right there. And my question to you is, why there? Why that land instead of, why didn't he give them, I mean, remember, Abraham was from way down here. Why didn't he just give them that land there? Why didn't he take them up to Anatolia? Why didn't he give them Egypt? Why didn't he give them somewhere else? What's so significant about that land, Canaan, that he gave them that land instead of somewhere else? Anybody want to ponder a guess? Say that again. It's beachfront property. Location, location, location. I'm sure those who lived on that part of the land enjoyed it for the beaches. Yeah, I'm sure they enjoyed that too. Aside from the beaches, do you think there might be another reason? Best for its people, okay? Certainly, well, how was the land described when talking to the Israelites as they were in bondage? Okay, land flowing with milk and honey. So it was certainly a desirable land, but is that the only land that would have been able to fit that description? I mean, certainly along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers there in Mesopotamia, there's some absolutely wonderful land that would be, that I think could just as well fit that description. But yes, it is a good land, but it's not the only land that could, that would be that way. Robbie? Okay. Robbie is hitting on something here. Crossroads of cultures. Expound on that a little bit. Why would that be significant? Or is that what I'm supposed to do? Okay. All right. He's exactly right that this is a major, major crossroads between different areas of the ancient Near Eastern world. Egypt as a world power, and you've got Syria or Aram in the north. You've also got the Babylonian region, Mesopotamia, and all of that. And guess where you've got to go through if you want to get from one to the other? You've got to go through the Levant region. You have to. Why can't you go, for instance, if you want to go from Egypt to Mesopotamia, which is, let's say you want to go down here, why can you not just go almost due east? Why would you have to go through this region right here? Because all of this, you can't tell from the map, but all of this right here is desert. You're not going to go through there. You're not going to make it. Anybody know what this region right here, the totality of that region is called? The Fertile Crescent. Okay, and aptly named because of all the water along the Tigris-Euphrates, and then here, the Jordan, and so forth. And that entire area is extremely fertile, while in contrast to this area right here, which is nothing but desert. And so if you are some nation up in Mesopotamia that wants to expand your borders, and Egypt is a major power, and you're butting heads against Egypt, and don't we see that all the time in the Old Testament? You see Egypt fighting against nations from the north, whether it be Aram or Assyria or you name it, Babylon, even in Babylon doing the same thing to Egypt, back and forth. And they're constantly crossing through that region, and not just crossing. When they cross through, are they politely asking for permission to cross through? No. They're not just coming through and saying, okay, I'm paying my toll so I can pass through on the interstate here, and I won't touch you, I won't bother you. No, they want that land too. Whoever it is, they want that land because that is a strategic land. It's a major thoroughfare, and whoever controls that land, that's a defensive posture to the rest of the world, to the rest of your empire, okay? So how does that play in to the Israelites being given that land? If that's the case, if this is a very tenuous and very precarious land because of the constant fighting back and forth, why on earth would God give them that land instead of putting them somewhere without all the conflict? And by the way, is there any conflict going on in that land today? There always has been for the same reasons. But why give them that land? Why not put them over here out of the way, or over here out of the way or something? Okay, so you're saying an influence upon the rest of the nations through his power and so forth?
Through his power, if he was with these people and the surrounding countries and people, knowing that these people had a God, that with them would happen over and over and over, that God would give them.
Okay. I think that is certainly part of it, and let's develop that idea a little bit more. This idea that God is showing his power not only to his own people, but it can influence the surrounding nations. and everybody that would potentially pass through there because God was with them. Okay, but what's the opposite of that, the flip side of the coin? When God is not with them, what happens? Okay. So what was the determining factor on them staying there and not being bothered by all the conflict that might potentially come their way? What was the determining factor in that? Say again. If they were righteous and if they had faith in God and obedient to God. And as long as that was the case, what was God's promises? He'd take care of them. He'd be with them. That land would be theirs, even though it's sitting in a very precarious area. And as soon as they left God, as soon as there was any kind of disobedience, I mean, think about the Judges period, for instance. During the Judges, you have the cycle where they are idolatrous and God will send them oppressors into the land. And then they will cry out to God and say, we've sinned, please deliver us. He'll send a deliverer, or a judge, a military leader, and they are delivered from their oppressor. Canaanites were very what? Wicked people, absolutely, absolutely. And so that brings up another point. One of the reasons why he does give them that land is not because of anything that the Israelites have done, but because he is judging the Canaanites, and he's using the Israelites to destroy them, to kick them out, to punish them for their wickedness. That is a point that's made over and over as well. But geographically speaking, the reason for this land, I believe, at least part of the reason, and maybe even a major reason, is to train the Israelites to trust him and rely upon him. That's a lesson we see replete in the scriptures. You trust in me, I'll take care of you. I'll be with you. And even though it looks like somebody is bigger, badder, more powerful, it's okay. I've got this, God says. That land is extremely conflict-riven. Always has been, always will be. But God said to them, as long as you're with me and I'm with you, no worries. Okay, and then we see, of course, the ultimate judgment upon them, both Israel and Judah, was to take them away from the land, to take the land away from them completely. Okay, does that make sense? Any questions or comments about that? All right, so that's just kind of a little bit of a tidbit about the Israelites and the land there, as we see in the Old Testament, and why that's the case. So let's move into some text now. And what we're going to be doing in this class is we're going to be going through the Old Testament in chronological order, not the way it's written, not in the order in which we have it in our Bibles. Now, granted, for a while, that's going to be in the order in which we have it in our Bibles, but then there's going to come a point where we're starting to skip around because it's not in chronological order. And I'm doing that so we can see the big picture, again, going back to the big picture view. And Genesis is the first book. We established before that the first five books were written by Moses, also called the Pentateuch. And we need to see Genesis in its bigger picture. A lot of us probably know most of the stories of Genesis. But again, we want to see this in the big picture and how it all fits together. In order to do that, I don't want us to start in Genesis. So if you're there, don't turn there. In fact, well, before I tell you where to turn, let me ask you. Who was Genesis written for? That's a question that you need to ask of every single book of the Bible as you begin to study it, is who was it written for? When was it written? Why was it written? All those questions are interrelated, of course. Who wrote it, things of that nature, because that gives you background information to help you interpret what you're reading. Okay. For the Israelites, Danny says, that were about to go into Canaan, I would correct that just a little bit. It's certainly for the Israelites, but I would say that it is originally for the first generation, because I think the evidence is there that it was written before that first generation was gone. But it's for the Israelites. Now, yes, it's for us. But if it was for the Israelites that were that came up out of Egypt, then we need to look at it with that viewpoint. And we're talking about the Exodus, and so we're actually going to go to Exodus to start this class tonight. Exodus chapter 19. In a sense, the Old Testament begins with the Exodus, not with Genesis, because of who Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are written to and why they're written. This is a brand new nation. God has just pulled them out of Egypt, delivered them from Egypt bondage. They are at the base of Mount Sinai. And they're there for 1 year before they start to prepare to go into the land. Now, of course, remember, they don't go into the land right away because of their unbelief, and they have to wander in the wilderness for 38 more years. But outside of that, the first year, though, they are in or at the base of Sinai. And think about the Israelites and their relationship with God before the plagues, before the deliverance from Egypt. How long had they been in Egypt? Now, y'all going to have to speak up a little bit louder because I cannot walk out there and hear you better. So I heard a couple of things. James, what did you say? 470 is, okay, 470 is one number that's given. Anybody else have a different number? Anybody want to challenge that? Yeah, you. James is going to challenge his own number. He's not totally sure about that. 430 is a number that is sometimes given. But there is some debate about that, depending upon how you read Genesis 15 and also how you read something in Acts or Galatians. They were either in Egypt for 215 years or they were there for 430 years, depending upon how you interpret it. Either way, they were there for a long time. Did they know Yahweh during that time? What kind of relationship did they have with Yahweh? They knew of him. They didn't have a law, obviously. That comes with the Exodus. But why do you say they knew of him, James? Okay. Ding, 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 ding. You get a free donut. Krispy Kreme at that. Panera in the morning? All right. Moses is writing Genesis to tell the Israelites who God is, for one. Because the Israelites don't know. Do you remember what Moses is afraid would happen when God sends him to Pharaoh to let the people go? One of the excuses he gives is something about the Israelites themselves and what they might say or what they might ask. Do you remember what question he anticipates? Who sent you? And who is this God? Okay. They may have known a little bit about him. They may have heard the history of their forefathers, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the God that he served. But also look at Joshua 24, and when Joshua is making his speech to the people, and that famous passage where he says, "Choose you this day whom you will serve." Do you remember the options he gives them? Either the gods that your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Okay, remember, Egypt is polytheistic. They don't serve Yahweh in Egypt. So serve either those gods or serve Yahweh. As for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. That's what Joshua says. And so while they may have known about Yahweh a little bit, they didn't really know him, and they did not have that relationship with him that Abraham would have had, or Isaac would have had, or Jacob would have had. And because over those years and through the Egyptian bondage, they had lost some of that, a good portion of it. So Genesis was written while they were at Mount Sinai, and part of the reason would have been to tell them about their history, to tell them about God, because they didn't know all that. Okay, we just sometimes assume that everybody back then would have known everything that's contained in Genesis. But remember, Genesis wasn't written until Moses wrote it down while they were at Sinai. So that's a lot of history, a lot of people that had lived on before, and there is no recorded history of that. Now, oral traditions, yes. But those oral traditions would have been kind of foggy to a degree by this time. Go to Exodus 19. And one of the things that we see here is, that God is doing is he is introducing himself to the Israelites. And I think that's the ultimate purpose here. Yes, he's going to be giving them a law, but they don't know him. And so in Exodus 19, he starts giving them instructions about this introduction. Look at verse 10. Exodus 19, verse 10. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, 'Take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. Not a hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain.'" So they have to consecrate themselves, prepare themselves, and we see later on Moses telling them to wash their clothes and to get ready for this introduction. Somebody describe to me the introduction that God gives them. What's the scene like? Describe the scene. Yeah, it's described both here in Exodus 19:20, as well as in Hebrews, a very frightening scene. Loud. What was making it so loud? Thunder, lightning. What else made it really, really loud? The voice of God. Y'all think I'm loud? I ain't got nothing. God's voice booming and speaking to them the Ten Commandments. Everybody heard it. That 1 to 3 million people gathered at the base of the mountain, and they're seeing and hearing the thunder, the lightning. What else do they see? Smoke and fire. And what are they feeling as well? Well, yeah, they're feeling fear, but what physical thing is taking place? There's the rumbling, the trembling, earthquake. The mountain is shaking. Man, it's an awesome sight. And they hear the voice of God speak to them, and what is their reaction to the voice of God? Yeah, they're afraid. What do they tell Moses? Yeah, we don't want to hear God speak to us anymore. We're too afraid. You go talk to him, find out what he wants to say, then come back and tell us. That's the introduction that God gives them. He chooses to introduce himself with tremendous power and speaking to them. This is the first time that these Israelites have been introduced to God, have known God. Yeah, they saw his acts in Egypt. They saw the plagues and so forth, but that was not an introduction to the Israelites. That was really God introducing himself to the Egyptians more so than the Israelites. And then in chapter 20 of Exodus, you have him speaking those Ten Commandments to them, the Decalogue. And the people all say that, hey, whatever God says, we're going to do it. But they don't know who God is up until this point. And so go back to Genesis now. And Genesis is written so that they can know who God is, so they can know their history in the history of the world. What does the word Genesis mean? Beginning or origins. It's an appropriate name. It's not the original name of the text in the Hebrew Bible, but it's our name for it in our English Bibles now. And, oh yeah, I was just showing you a size comparison to Alabama. Let me give you a very simple outline breakdown of the book of Genesis. Again, overview, big picture stuff. Genesis chapter 1 through 11 is the primeval history. What does that word primeval mean? Anybody know? We hear that word a lot, but may not know what it means. It just means a really, really early history. Prime, meaning first or coming before, youthful, and then evil has to do with age or eon. So it's the early, early history of the world. I think if you would have asked any of the or the average Israelite at the base of Mount Sinai after they came up out of Egypt, do you know the history of the world? They probably would have said no. They probably wouldn't have had much of a clue about what we find in chapters 1 through 11. They may know some of it, but probably not all of it. And so Genesis 1 through 11 is that primeval history. And this would include, of course, the creation, the fall of man. It would include the flood. It would include the story of the Tower of Babel. And then where the nations came from after that. And then chapters 12 through 50, you have patriarchal history. And this would include Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, etc. So in the first 11 chapters, thinking about who this is written for and the purpose for which it's written, God is not just, remember I've said this about the King's class too, God is not just telling them history just so they can be able to answer the trivia questions when asked. It's not the purpose of the history in the Bible. There's a theological purpose behind all the history written down in the Bible. What would be the theological point of chapters 1 through 11, the primeval history? It's the same point for us too. Okay, creation. How did we get here? And the answer to that is God, Yahweh, not Isis in Egypt, or Ra, or whoever the Egyptian gods were in Egypt. And there's only one God. And he's not just God of the Israelites, but he's the creator of all the nations. He is the God of the entire world. And all those other gods don't exist. That's what Genesis 1 through 11 is telling you. And the condition of man, the spiritual condition, is telling them about that as well. And so all of that is to make the point that, okay, this God that you've just been introduced to, he's not just one of the many gods that are out there, and he happens to be the God of Canaan, of that territory, whereas the Egyptian gods were the gods of that particular territory. No, this is Yahweh. He's the God. He's the one that created everything. So not only that, but then, so he's not just the God of their forefathers, he's the God of all in the world. And go to chapter 12 of Genesis, please. Because there we have, I believe, one of the top five passages in the Bible. Absolutely a crucial set of verses. Genesis 12, and we're going to read verses 1 through 3. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Why is that such an important set of verses? Why do I say that ranks in the top five? Okay. That may very well be the case. I don't know if it was that or if there was some skin color difference. I wouldn't imagine there would be that much difference in skin coloration from the people that lived in Canaan to the people that lived in Egypt. I don't know for sure. But we do know, of course, that circumcision had been instituted with Abraham. And even though they didn't really know Yahweh at this point, that's still something, though, that they would have kept as a tradition of the Israelites. And, you know, there would be some connection there, but not the full connection that they need to make with God. Is your question, is that how she would have known? Is that the question? Right. Isaac and so forth, right. Yeah, that's a very, very distinct possibility. And I would say it's highly likely that that's the case. Before, it was right before the conquest. Yeah, it had probably continued from the time of Abraham, and most likely, at least with the vast majority of the Israelites, there may have been some that didn't. I don't know why they wouldn't have, but in any case, I would say that that was probably true. They just didn't have that relationship with Yahweh like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did. That had been lost in the Egyptian bondage. So let's go to chapter 12 and verse 1 through 3, and what is so important about these verses? These are the promises to Abraham. We typically break it up into three parts. What are those three parts? Those three promises: nation, land, and seed. Okay. Why is this a big deal? All right, great point, Steve. Steve said, of all the people in the world, and by the way, go back one chapter, and you'll see a whole bunch of people named there from chapter 11, the Tower of Babel, and you have this table of nations and these descendants and so forth. And you may ask yourself, why on earth is this genealogy in the Bible? Why does it really matter? Because one of the points, and maybe even the main point that's being made, is of all these people, God chose Abraham to focus on. And from chapter 12 on, it's not about all these other people anymore. It's about Abraham and his descendants. I would have to look back. I don't remember if it was Ham, Shem, or Japheth. I'd have to look back at that. But from this point on, it's all about this one particular individual and this line. And these promises that were made to Abraham, what's so special about those promises? Okay. Ultimately, that third part, the seed promise, is referring to Christ, and that everybody would be able to inherit these blessings or be part of these blessings. Go to Galatians 3 real quickly, please. I want to tie this in. Again, we're doing big picture stuff here, so I do want to tie it in to a point that Paul makes in Galatians 3. And look at verse 26. Okay. The big issue in Galatians is Gentile Christians versus Jewish Christians. Judaizing teachers trying to make the Gentiles become Jews. That's the main issue that Paul has to deal with throughout his apostleship. And he's making the point here, you know what? You Gentiles are receiving the promises as well. You're inheriting the promises. For you are all sons, I'm in verse 26, you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. Therefore, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. What promise? Genesis 12, 1 through 3. And while there was obviously a physical component to those promises in verses 1 through 3 of Genesis 12, ultimately it was a foreshadowing of the spiritual promises. The land promise, the song that Clint led us in tonight, the last verse talked about us going to the promised land. That was the ultimate reality of the promised land. It was not the physical land. The Hebrew writer makes the point also that that rest, that deliverance still exists. The people of old did not really inherit it like they were meant to inherit it. It's still there for us. The nation. Okay, we are true Israel. We are the true Jews, the spiritual nation of Israel. And then, of course, the blessings of Christ and the salvation and forgiveness that we have in Christ Jesus and the blessings that we have through him. So Genesis 12, 1 through 3, some of the most important verses in Scripture for all the implications both of the Israelites and for us today as well. So Genesis is written to tell them the primeval history in chapters 1 through 11, but also to tell them their history, their particular nation's history, and how God has chosen them to be that special nation and have that relationship with them. And one other little small point I'll make as we close up here tonight. Something I found interesting in my study in preparation for this is that throughout Genesis, oh, you know what? I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Before we get there, go to Genesis 15. Yeah, the promises made to Abraham in Genesis 12, in Genesis 15, he reaffirms these promises and enters into this covenant with Abraham. And take a look at, let's see here, verse 13. This is after that ceremony of entering into the covenant with the animals that were split in half and God passing through them and so forth. It says in verse 13, "Then he, speaking of God, said to Abram, 'Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will afflict and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years.'" That's where part of that 400 years comes from, is this verse here. "And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age, but in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." So there is a prophecy that God gives to Abraham regarding his descendants. The people that Moses is writing to, they're going to see that and hear that, read that. That's talking about us. And that's exactly what happened. And it says they will come out with great possessions. What is that an allusion to that later on did happen when they came out of Egypt? How did they come out? And what was the manner in which they came out? They what? They broke Egypt. Remember how the Egyptians were saying, "Please leave, and by the way, take all of our gold and silver and money and so forth with you. Please do that. Just get out of here." So when they came out, I mean, they were slaves to begin with, but when they came out, they were richer than the Egyptians. And that's what this is foreshadowing here in verse 14. Okay, so when you read through Genesis, one thing you notice very quickly is there's a lot of dishonesty, a lot of lying going on amongst people. Where's the first lie in Genesis? Say it again. In the garden. Who said it? Who told the lie? The serpent did. Okay, remember him lying about what God had said or what would happen or not happen to them? And you keep on going and you see people lying over and over again. You see Abraham lying to Pharaoh. You see Isaac do the same thing. Jacob, what does Jacob's name mean? Deceiver. It's just rampant throughout Genesis. You have this dishonesty, and man cannot be trusted. But guess who can? Guess who always fulfills his word. God does. There's this contrast in the stories of Genesis with man versus what God has done and is doing with his people. He always fulfills his promises. He can be trusted. Man cannot. So, summarization very quickly, and then I'll be done. Genesis is really a prologue to Exodus. It's an introduction. It's a 50-chapter introduction to Exodus and to their nation and what they were going to be doing from this point forward and the nation that they were going to become. So it's teaching the Israelites their history, the history of Yahweh, and of course about to bring them into this relationship with their God. All right, questions, comments in the last 30 seconds that we have? Points that you want to make? You've got not just conflict from neighbors to the north like Syria or to the south with Egypt, but right next door you've got Jordan and Palestine, those nations, and the conflict there, and they do not get along. When we were there in 2011, that was something that we found out very, very quickly, was that conflict, and it is a very tenuous relationship. Yeah. And let me just play off of that just very quickly. This conflict on the land, that's a point that we need to understand. Yeah, that was a prompt. That's what I was talking about earlier, the promises to Abraham. All the conflict that's going on is over the physical land, thinking it belongs to them. This is all part of God's promise and so forth. What they don't understand is that was ultimately a spiritual promise. The land promise has been fulfilled physically. It's now the spiritual land that we're looking forward to.